Welcome, April 23, 2022. Focus for this piece is looking at the several statements coming out "We've all but authenticated them." Speaking in terms of what is being floated out there, the extent of the Russian special operation, the extent being to leave Ukraine, what's left of Ukraine. This is the rump state scenario, one of the rump state scenarios that we talked about, leaving the rest of Ukraine as a landlocked country. People have asked about the legality of that, and, you know, that's a... The approach for some time has been what has been allowed, what has already gotten away with. And as those are challenged, there's a process through the UN, but for a country to be recognized, but there are any number of political entities, you know, semi-autonomous or otherwise in the world that don't fit into the UN schema of things. It would be like extra nice if it would be like that, but probably better it's not. Not every country that has maybe plus one or plus two votes on the general committee of the UN, the General Assembly, rather, you don't want them deciding who's a country, because those votes can be bought. Like, imagine all of the ones that you could just buy very fast. Like Zaire, Guatemala, like knocking those off. So if this goes down, this is what we've been looking at today. There's been, we want to mention that Colonel Kassad, whose name is Boris Rosen, but his like moniker has been Colonel Kassad for a number of years, blogging in Russia. He has like one of those old school live journals, you know, those live journals, pretty old school. A lot of Russians invested into that early on. They still keep them up. And he uses his live journal to blog about the war. And he says, quote, "Despite the absence of a general offensive, the Russian Federation Armed Forces nevertheless continue to conduct offensive operations in the Izium area. There is an advance in the area of Slavyansk. The front is approaching Krasny Liman, Yampol, and Seversk, as well as in Zaporizhye, east of Gallipoli." So that's his directionals. But what his point is this, he finishes, "But it is obvious that most of the forces have not yet been put into action." And so he's saying there hasn't been a general push. there's just been this, you know, there hasn't been a general, this is the day, right? This is the push, men, a general offensive. Operation something something, right? What would they name the operation to wrap up with these 60,000 Ukrainians in the field there? What would they call that one? But anyway, while he says that there are scattered advances, more like cleaning up and positioning the how they want this line of contact to shape up, kind of shaping the field. You know, hedge it over there, trim it up over there, push them a little, you know. A lot of micro-tactical considerations. This hill, that hill, this bunker, these little things, this little settlement, those guys in that ranch house, that kind of stuff. Just what can you clean up and kind of hedge, trim this line of conflict up, this area of operations up into something so that when they do push. So that's a very interesting, to me, is a very interesting metric because to begin with, you only have 10 or 15% of the Russian force engaged in Ukraine. And then in addition to that, you know, maybe at most 20%. I don't, you know, I'm not looking at, I don't have satellite imagery, but just from what you know, the numbers of the Russian military. So, okay. They've got 150,000 there. They've got 900,000 or a million more back home. Okay. And then you have Colonel Kassad, that's Boris Rosen. He's saying on the line in the Donbass that most of the forces have not been put into action. So there was this whole movement of forces out of Kiev region, and they maneuvered over eastward and then down into Ukraine, into the, I guess, actually the republics that Russia recognizes, former Ukraine. We were the first here to talk about the former Ukraine. You know, like that expression, the former Yugoslavia? We started talking about the former Ukraine. Now, in terms of the question of whether the UN resolutions are enforceable international law, for a person to ask whether treaties and international customs seem stronger sources, sure. The one that we're dealing with in play, I mean, there's the the Minsk agreement, and that was, those were treaties between the signatory countries. There was the contact group, the Minsk agreement. There was the Normandy 4 format, but that helped, I think, to frame the Minsk 2 agreement in the end. But these are agreements between countries. And then it was memorialized at the level of the UN as UN Security Council Resolution 2202. And that's those at the level of the Security Council. They are enforceable de facto. This is a method that the United States has used and that Russia now uses but Russia doesn't. Russia could use it. I mean, we've used it, rather, we should say. Russia has actually justified its incursion into Ukraine based on different articles of the UN on the protection of people. So they invoked another article, and they did it through their. They also did it through the processes and the arguments they raised through the Council of Europe and the OSCE. So yeah, those are all treaty and custom treaty or customs type organizations. It's the same, you know, treaty custom organizations. The UN, your member state, those do act at the level effectively of as treaties when you agree when you're in that system. But just in terms of, you know, bilateral agreements or trilateral, et cetera, agreements, though, that is what came out of the Minsk agreement, that those were, you know, direct treaty agreements signed by the countries for a ceasefire, in fact. And then that became the UN Security Council resolution. But the UN General Assembly resolutions are not enforceable by international law. And that's a very dangerous zone that we're getting into. Because remember, it was the United States that began to take unilateral action on UN Security Council resolutions, even despite that resolution not having, you know, actionable language like a process after which it's violated. And then, you know, the UN Security Council has to convene and they agree almost beforehand that they're going to take action a certain way. You know, the U.S. has interpreted UN Security Council resolutions such way that it's not required to have actionable language in the resolution. They'll just act unilaterally if they determine sort of themselves that the, you know, resolution's been breached. So Russia has followed that same, you know, things. I am saying, you see, but they haven't justified it. The U.S. has actually justified their actions based on that. So it's important to make a distinction between the two, right? What I'm saying that Russia could make their argument on in such case, that if people want to raise it or conversationally, let's look at what's being floated semi-officially. I mean, it's coming out of official channels. Don't get me wrong. I just posted it right now on the main channel, so you can check it out. What's being floated semi-officially. Although someone else from Crimea or from Kherson said that, oh no, it has to go through Dnipropetrovsk. But I don't see that as being a necessary outcome. But just with the ones that have been listed outright, this is what is being listed outright at this point, right? So they could change this, of course. This is all fluid. This is all fluid. The deputy commander of the Central Military District said that in the second phase of the military operation, the Russian army plans to establish full control over Donbas and southern Ukraine to provide a corridor for Crimea. Now, that could be just the south east, right? But then we heard the earlier today, okay, because we're talking about the corridor to Crimea, okay? But the Moldovan Foreign Ministry summoned the Russian ambassador to explain the plans of the Russian army to liberate Ukraine to Transnistria. And that is, if you look at the map, you know, everything from Crimea going westward, right? Crimea going westward. So that's, you know, past Kherson into Mykolaiv and Odessa regions. there had been already a lot of activity on Mykolaiv, and I would have to look and see with you right now if they have where they're in the general map of things, where they are claiming if they have any activity. To what extent their activity goes there. It looks pretty much like they are not in the Mykolaiv area on the ground, but they could be. Well, no, I take that back. No, they're claiming, it looks like because they're past the river. Right. Wow. Look at that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a realistic claim. You wouldn't have them. I mean, they could justify having their military beyond the area. I mean, they already did. They established that at the beginning. One of the things that they established by doing what they did with Kiev and the Kiev Oblast generally, and one could also say Zhytomyr and Chernihiv, is they established in the first place that we can have the military go in places that we're not claiming are the areas that we are going to liberate. Okay. That, I think a lot of people don't appreciate how important that was, because you can imagine they've done it once already, right? They did it, right? They did it. They went in like on the beginning, they went in. And what did that do? That, like, you know, established the precedent. It established a precedent that you can't have this, because the reasons that they went in, they played, you know, multiple reasons at the same time, right? Like, we're going in to defend these regions that we said are independent countries, okay? But we also have to demilitarize and denazify the whole of Ukraine. Like, oh, well, those are two different, you know, these are two different things, guys. I mean, you know, of course, the larger goal would secure the smaller goal, right? but is that how things always work? And when the Russians went into Georgia in 2008, they went far beyond, you know, borders of the areas that they were, you know, liberating. And the U.S. Ambassador actually asked them that question, and he was quite a reasonable man. And the question was not, you know, posed in a snarling way. It was reasonable for an American ambassador's job to deal with Russia, I should say. He was not a snarling man anyway. And he kind of just posed it, and it sounded like a pretty innocent question. Like, if you guys are trying to liberate these areas, why are you going all these other areas? And it was fairly obvious, the answer, when you go, oh, yeah, of course. It's like, you know, the opponent's ability to project power on targets that target the area that you're protecting are resources that are located all throughout their territory. It's not like the territory that you need to protect, that's not like the same place that the opponent or the threat is operating from within. They could be mounting their power and shooting artillery from well into their area, or their whole ability to conduct the conflict. It's most reasonable, instead of having a war of attrition on the land, is if you can do it, and if it's going to save resources and lives, you disrupt their entire chain of command, or their whole central command, right? So that would, you know, you'd have to like strike stuff in Kiev or in Warsaw, Poland at this point. So, I mean, you can understand that the rationalization, or the rationale rather, you know, for doing that is already justified in the discursive framework that is long established and long described in U.S.-Russia bilateral talks. And it's not new. It's not a new concept. It's just on the information war, you know, they establish from the very beginning, like, okay, boom, we're in Chernihiv, we're in
Kiev region, etc. Right, we're in Zhytomyr region, and they kind of just popped in, right? And so now you can't have like, you know, the role of the Europeans to kind of like middle this out as much as possible. We've described that at length in our past talks. You know, they might have posed something along the lines of like, well, so long as you're only operating in these areas where you've already conducted these referendums, where the citizens, only if it's in these areas that citizens have conducted referendums. And it's like, well, no, that can't be the limiting principle for Russia. I mean, we can describe the problem of, even if they had agreed to that with, you know, Europeans and how to manage the expectations here, right? We're talking about managing expectations and kind of what Europe is willing to allow a lot more than the U.S. is rhetorically, you know, pretending that they have the power to allow or disallow. But, you know, it's the Americans are really pushing along the more unreasonable aspects of all of this. I mean, the Europeans are basically, their unreasonableness, the weapons and stuff that they're providing is not unreasonableness, you know. Unreasonableness is the economic consequences that their sanctions are doing on Europe, right? It's not their response militarily has been like, you know, more responsible than not responsible, and especially knowing all of the security lapses that they've done, and it's not making it hard for Russia to contain that and to manage that, and so. That's a you know, all those things that this, whatever the status quo becomes at a time and the parties adapt and find it acceptable becomes a tacit agreement. You know, you don't have to have an overt agreement, but as I tend to suspect that such talks about things that don't need to be agreements have happened parallel to the real gravity of the situation. So I think the Europeans generally, old Europe, that is, has a much more moderate approach to the conflict than the Langley guys and the, you know, boys in DC. That's just my read of the situation. I think that's what people generally have looked and seen when they look at this. But we're looking at this these new proposals that are being floated. It's like right sub. It is sub of semi-official. It's right below official that they're going to take Odessa and Mykolaiv, and the way they have to do that is through these processes of the citizens, you know, doing a vote. It's called a referendum. So let me now open up a questions section for you. And from there is where I'll look at a few questions, hopefully, relating to just what the subject is, so that, you know, there's some coherent, connection between what we're talking about. And the first question is a good one. What will be left of Ukraine after the operation, territorial-wise? And how will Ukraine get the weapons being pumped in by the West and handed out willy-nilly to every Tom, Dick, and Harry under their control? That's a good question. If we look at it, it's realistic to include Dnipropetrovsk in this map that we've just shown on the main channel page. It's like a red and white map. I just popped in color for the areas that is being, you know, floated very strongly. I mean, it's let's get the who is saying it so that we can get that out of the way. So the deputy commander of the Central Military District is already saying, you know, for sure a corridor for Crimea through Kherson and Zaporizhia. And Mariupol was the most important strategic location for making that possible. That's in the Donetsk region that the uprising happened. But to have now, we saw that people in some part of Zaporizhia had formed a committee, had voted out of their committee to start the process of a making a referendum to be an independent country. But this meeting went in the direction of to join Donetsk. What's interesting is that the broader Zaporizhia region, like geographic region, includes part of Donetsk and Dnipropetrovsk. So I don't know, you know, what the mood is there or how, but apparently from this one meeting, maybe, I don't know if it was a particular region that they want to redivide and put it into Donetsk, or they want all of Zaporizhia to be part of the Donetsk Republic, right? Or, you know, they would be their own. But it, from the Central Military District, Russian, the deputy commander of the Russians for the Central Military District is saying here that Zaporizhia and Kherson are going to be some entity that's Russian allied and separate from Ukraine. Okay. And then the this same deputy commander said that the objectives of the second stage also include a corridor to Transnistria, right? So from the Nikolaev and Odessa regions that we have on the map here. And he reported that the second phase, I guess, in all of its glory, began 2 days ago. So between the movement of all these forces that basically out of Kiev and Cherniv overthrew the Belarusian and Russian side and then put some of those back into circulate through Kharkiv and Lugansk, right? Then they're in there handling that issue. And it's only until 2 days ago that there's been a lot of activity, right? And yet Kassad is saying that they're saying this operation second phase, I guess after all the repositioning is done and then the continued drama at the Azovstal plant down south in, you know, Mariupol in the Donetsk region there, all of that looks kind of like just the feeling of it is like things were announced or we thought things were happening. And then like another couple weeks went by, like 3 weeks or something, before this was all right, like in place. So am I reading that right? That's how it seems to me. And now we're hearing, okay, now the second phase is starting. Kassad, you know, Boris Rosian is saying, no, well, there hasn't been a general offensive that has started, even though probably from the name of their, whatever their operation is or whatever, they're saying that they're ready and they're starting. That's 2 days ago. So we'll probably have clarity on what that means, that it started. My thoughts on Lviv, on the idea that it's Poland's stolen land from the days of the USSR. Yeah, I mean, they could, it's Poland's military role in this doesn't work out in ways that make sense very much, right? For Ukraine or for Ukrainian nationalists, especially for the Banderas. This is a very interesting contradiction. The Polish ultranationalists, who are pushing the hardest for the anti-Russian policy in Poland, you know, very much dislike the Galicians, you know, the Pravi sector, the Azov, the, you know, they don't like Ukrainian neo-Nazism because that was also an anti-Polish movement that ethnically cleansed hundreds of thousands of Poles from the Lviv and I think Volyn regions and around, mostly the western parts of the country. So it's a very, 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 very tense, you know, where they're going to bring in Polish peacekeepers. Well, the Ukrainians would be like, no, this is a double backstab. Like there's something like if you get Polish peacekeepers in there and then they decide they don't want to move out, you know, then they start building Polish cultural institutions is what like Turkey is doing in the Turkish kind of parts of northern Syria. So very, 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 very interesting development today. No, it's very interesting to look at the map and to see, you know, how they might justify that. They would need to control it militarily, control it administratively, and then have the people there do the, you know, stage these referendums, unfurl the banner, some local leader, some, you know, guy, maybe younger guy, maybe older guy with white hair, with one of those like 1970s, you know, like those Russian versions of a Wayaveta that they always wear when they're like on in the southern Russia or on the Black Sea for vacation. But very good question. Turning the page. Not going to address rumors, but, who can handle things in Russia in the absence of Putin? I think you can see the team around him and you have a lot of competence around him and it would just be a question of whether people could get behind one, if they could stick, you know, with the vision, stick with the commitment. But there are, you know, well, if I were to say Medvedev, a lot of people are like, oh, no way, you know, like that's like he's kind of pro-Western and stuff. And that's kind of like the illusion, but that doesn't mean on the other, just because that's the illusion doesn't mean that there, you know, that there's not a double or triple illusion possible. But that's, you know, no one really believes that now. Like when he came in, remember they did the whole reset thing with the button and like, but it, like the Americans translated the Russian wrong. And like, it was like fire, like a nuke detonate. But it was a stupid thing. The reset in relations with Medvedev. But you know, he's competent and could do it. I don't know. I don't think he inspires. I think he's been kind of like if you look at his lately, the way his posture is on his Telegram, and which is cool because it's like Twitter but not retarded, because you can get some, you know, 1,000-word essays in there, right? on a single post on Telegram instead of whatever 180 characters on Twitter. So it's pretty cool, and so he's kind of laying it out. He's you know, coming off like he's you know, a badass or whatever. But there's, you know, Lavrov understands the Russian situation very well, but you know, I don't know that he would outlive or, you know, be around for very long regarding Putin. But you know, there's a number of people. There was, you know, there are some younger people that could work out. You know, it's all just sort of like the ideas, like, but not just, it's the ideas in terms of what's guiding your orientation and what is your approach, but not the same thing as do the people have the ability. You know, you have someone younger, I mean, you have, if the people that kind of came out around Sergei Ivanov, Vasily Yakmenko back in, you know, 2007, remember these guys, Boris Brislov, these characters, Vladislav Surkov, his whole thing with sovereign democracy. These are all formative ideas that kind of frame Russia's, you know, view. Now officially they kind of moved past the sovereign democracy stage. Like a couple years ago they announced it, like 2019 or something like that. It's like kind of Russia moving past the sovereign democracy stage. That was huge. They were changing the constitution some, but yeah, you can basically whatever seems like is the directional flow from sovereign democracy to more like a Eurasian kind of orientation, of Eurasian integration posture, maybe. But it goes past it. It's basically the sovereign democracy 2.0. I mean, you could say you're past it, but they're not going in a direction worse than sovereign democracy, like away into something like, you know, this is greater sovereign now. They just announced that they were kind of like moving past the sovereign democracy stage. But, you know, but Surkov's thing had been, you know, for a long time. I mean, it was... I think he first started talking about it like in the summer of 2005 or 2006, you know, but, there's questions here. Yeah, I'm just looking at your questions. Yes, you can see, you can see the map. This is what's being floated. And maybe we'll get some correction on that. Maybe we'll be like, no, we were just saying, you know, hypothetically, you know, maybe they're floating this as like a come to the negotiating table kind of thing. But the reason I share this now is that what's missing from this map, in the what many people would say, okay, is that if you look at the usage of Russian language in macro regions and kind of have a sense of that, right, you would have Chernov, Sumy, Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk included with Odessa, Mykolaiv, Kherson, and Zaporizhia and Kharkov. So starting just with Donetsk and Lugansk, where what is now pretty clear is going to be the deal is Kharkov, Zaporizhia, Kherson, okay. And the only thing that we are waiting to see if they're going to, you know, clarify that they're not going to do, or, you know, I just don't get too excited or too, you know, oh, they're doing this, because they can say it and they have the power to unsay it. So I say like, you give all these things like the 48-hour rule. You know what I mean? You always have to give these things like some time to be wrong or to be confirmed. But these are pretty authoritative sources now saying that the Russian aim is to liberate Odessa. Odessa is a huge city. It has always been a Russian city. Just it's always been considered. It's never been considered a Ukrainian city. That's for sure. It's sort of like the Greek Russian. It's kind of like Crimea. It's sort of like these. It's been a Russian city since the 18th and 19th century, and that's what built it up to what it is. It's not a Ukrainian city. It's been Ukrainianized, you know, and you know, people with connections and North Odessa region, right? But Odessa's like Romanians and Hungarians, and it's sort of like this Budapest of the. People think Budapest is like this, you know, oriental city where East meets West. It's really not. It's more like Belgrade and Odessa. Odessa is definitely this, you know, major crossroads, and it's on the Black Sea. It's huge. It's a very big city population-wise, too. It's one of the largest in, I think it's just after Kharkov in terms of population size, but check me on that if I'm wrong. But I think it's 1 million people. Let's take a look real fast, actually. Let's take a look at some of the details of Odessa. Give me about 30 seconds and we'll be right back to talk about, because this is a very big thing to announce that you're taking Odessa region. Okay, and we're back. Now, just something to, I guess, sort of like nuts and bolts, or P's and Q's, really more like it, is when I'm talking about what seems likely or what makes sense, these are not value judgments. I'm just saying what looks like it makes sense in terms of the military or the strategic angle. And when I talk about maybe history of areas as I understand it, it's not to lend anyone any particular moral authority or to subtract any authority from anyone else. Just because an area was founded by Russia or used to be Russia, or wouldn't exist if Russia hadn't created it, or if the Russians hadn't lived there as the majority of the people who lived there. I mean, these may be all facts about talking about a certain part of Ukraine, but there are many instances around the world where, you know, the balance of population changes, or a upper middle class or ruling class of a different ethnic minority from an adjacent country or from far away, develop significant political or social power in another country. All these things are real existing processes. It's not a, one can describe that that's happening and not say it should or shouldn't happen. So you see, those are two different things. So we're looking at Odessa and we're looking as close as we can. And it is 1 million people, maybe 1.2, 1.1 million people. It was established in the place of an older sort of Eastern named settlement called Khazibe, or Khazibe. And seems to be maybe like a Tatar or there was any number of quasi-Turkic or Turkish, you know, Slavic mixes of people that had that used the Eastern titles as a cultural influence. You don't visualize very big racial differences. A lot of these Cossack groups, whether they were Christian or not, came out of this kind of same, you know, Oriental way of life. They're like very like much like spin-offs of that. Cossacks are very, you know, very much spin-offs of other types of Turkish, not Turkish, but, you know, Ottoman, Turco-Slavic culture. It's not Turkish in the sense of Turkish nationalism or, you know, Ataturk or anything like that. It's not like that concept. The relationship between the Ottomans and the Turks was also very different. You know, it was people referred to the people that they saw as Turks, but in the Ottoman Empire, the ruling class was like Persian, was Iranian, and they spoke Farsi. I mean, they were intermarried and there was different, you know, I'm generalizing, but there were definitely Turks, you know, running it a lot of the time too, people who were Turkish, but there are different Turkish groups in Turkey too, and they're not all united and they have a fight, especially in this period of time, you know, in the Ottoman period. But, you know, like when the proverbial excrement hit the propeller and you have all these crises within internal Ottoman politics, that's when in the mode of crisis did all of the other crises affect, you know, whether it was, you know, Kurds, Armenians, Greeks, Lydians, different, you know, Greek Lydians or Greek Pontic, Trebizond, a lot of Greek cities in the country now called Turkey. And but the definition of what it meant to be Turkish was sort of like turned from about 15 up to over 100 on the dial within a very short period of time. As the Ottoman power was contracting and their existence as a system forming state was in rapid decline, and they were therefore began to reinforce themselves to reinforce what they thought could be a stronger position. This is all from a functionalist perspective. I'm like leaving out what ideologists fighting for these things believed about themselves. I'm just talking about the process more like factologically or from like the, you know, the view at 30,000 feet or what have you, right? So Ottoman power contracted, and so it was logical. It makes sense, right? That a power vector would emerge that was focused on the question of them being a larger defined people forming state. And so then they like started passing a bunch of, they had been doing laws and stuff like everyone who's defined as this is now a Turk. It was a multinational empire. Even within the empire, it was very like the bazaars, you know, the markets were very international, and there was like Greek quarters and Serbian quarters and Bulgarian quarters. There was all these different types of towns on the Anatolian side, you know, on the Asian side of the Ottoman realm. So, and then there was a big period of like standardizing everybody and trying to make everyone Turk, like a certain type of Turkish. And that's all. So it led to a lot of problems. you know, in the West and the East, you know, with the Armenians, that's a whole other story. That, you know, genocide of the Armenians is a whole other story. So, you know, Hitler was in fact, partly inspired by the ability of that collapsing situation to cover up the genocide of the Armenians. So, you know, but that doesn't mean that, like, the Turks themselves were also in the best, or because there's different groups of Turks, as we were explaining. And that doesn't mean that all Turks were happy or all Turks benefited as a class at all different times in the Ottoman Empire or in all places of the Ottoman Empire as an empire. It's not, you know what I mean? It wasn't a giant Turkish ethno-nationalist state, right? It was not Turkey. It's not the same thing. So it was more like the Far Eastern Roman Empire, or like a Roman Persian hybrid empire, where like Turkish forces were a big part of what made it happen. That's all. So it was sort of like a variation of like the Roman Empire in the East, and kind of mixed in with Persian, which that always was anyway, right? So, you know, just it, there's not. When I look at the present, you know, tone of Turkey, I don't say what should have been, what could have been. I just look at, like, those are the events that made Turkey Turkey. You know, now I want to understand what they're doing in, you know, northern Syria, or what, you know, to what extent their networks within Kurds and against Kurds and through Kurds and to put down Kurds that they were, you know, playing with over here, you know, encouraging over there, repressing in the same, at the same, with the other hand, yet, you know, yet a third time over yonder. It's just a very strange, bizarre relationship that Turkey has with Kurds, but they're certainly positioned to not give up any territory that they have in northern Syria. And those games that we saw about, you know, a couple of weeks ago with Azerbaijan and Armenia were, you know, absolutely a proxy flex of like Turkey doing something in a way. But I'm not that, you know, I don't blame Turkey for being Turkey. I'm not, you know, you have to untangle all these narratives, or, you know, who you like, or Erdogan's a, you know, this Muslim Brotherhood, or, you know, you have to untangle a lot of this stuff and just look at what they're doing and what they said they would do. And there was an older number two or three guy in Turkey, you know, a decade ago. And he was not the same as, you know, as Erdogan by any stretch. And if his name comes to me, I'll remember it. But he was promoting a policy of the neo-Ottomanism. That was like his thing, was neo-Ottomanism. Now he's not the guy anymore, right? And Erdogan pivoted away from his political relationship with him, if I understand correctly. But I mean, just because that's a formal thing. I mean, like Erdogan's pivoted on a number of different, you know, things throughout his time, coming from one vector and being against them the next day on the other. Several different groups of people he's done that to, back and forth. I mean, so very, very interesting character, Erdogan. Anyway, but the Turkish realm used to be all in the, at a certain peak of its power, all in, you know, southern Russia. And there was kind of these, you know, gray zones where people didn't really know, you know, people didn't really know where they were from. I mean, see, when you talk about the past, we talk about like 300 years ago and 400 years ago. Even until something like 20 years ago, half of people on the planet never ventured more than 50 miles or what is that, 80 kilometers or so from their place of birth. And, you know, when you go back 300-400 years ago, people didn't even think of themselves as being from a particular village or town unless there was like with reference to another village or town, right? Like there's aspects of identity which are kind of constructed through knowledge of the other, right? So at any rate, is people have mentioned that it will be difficult for the Russian forces to impose a military solution or military outcome to the effect of the territory that they're talking about, you know, quote unquote liberating. And, The problems that are going to happen in the former Soviet stands. Turning the page to another question. What is happening in some of these ex-Soviet stand countries? What is their stance? Is it, well, there will tend to be pressures on those countries to turn up the dial, but it would really start first with the rhetorical dial. And if at the very worst, it's a rhetorical or maybe symbolic diplomatic kind of row, but it doesn't result in any, you know, real consequence in the policy, and then it kind of fizzles out and then they're friends again. I mean, that could happen very easily, increasingly, and still not be at the level of a problem. But I believe that when push comes to shove, they won't get crazy. Not in a military sense, they're right there in between China and Russia. And if Russians were sanctioned out and Chinese weren't, then it would be a very big power play by China, not very social, not very friendly to Russia, if they had a very open posture to investment, you know, into those countries. And if Russia had been specifically blocked, right, that would be pretty unfriendly, right, for China to do that. But, you know, I'm not suggesting that they would. But yes, those have been good questions. And I thank you for them. Looking at this development on the map, I'm just thinking what it would take militarily to defend that. It not including Dnipropetrovsk, it seems that you could have a line of, you know, that just in your country security, that there's too much area of border, you know, without that region, there's just way too much territory of open border. That seems like it's a strategic difficulty to manage in terms of any ongoing 10-year-long, what was it, Arestovich thing, 10-year-long campaign. So I wouldn't be surprised if that central Western region or Eastern region would go over would have to be, you know, there have to be the, these military operations there would, I think, have to include that in the end, for sure. There's just too much territory. It's just open. You have too much of Kherson, and, you know, Zaporizhia is open. It's just not thinking about the line of territory that you want to try to close up. And that other message out of Crimea about wanting to connect by rail directly from Kherson through to Kharkiv by rail means you have to have a Dnipropetrovsk. So I think that's a very good possibility. Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, I just wanted to look at the situation as it is developed. And again, just to say it again for like the 10th time, these are just like things that I'm seeing floated that seem like, you know, part of the information games. And we'll see if they're like clarified, negated, refuted. I mean, they very well could be. I think the Mykolaiv and Odessa thing seems a bit, you know, like not what they would try to do if they, or would be talking about doing at this time, really, unless the other areas of conflict right now were already done deals. I mean, it's kind of a lot to announce. Kind of seems that you would be telling them where to be building up the forces. Just things like that are just kind of weird to me. So that's what I think about it. And, I think we would expect to see like some clarification that this is not, in fact, you know, what's going to be their aim. Like what the map that I put, I'm saying, I think that's just like one statement, and maybe they're just floating it to see how people will react, or it may be used in some kind of unmentioned thing in the diplomatic realm. What they might try to negotiate, who knows, about to compel talk about Azovstal. Who knows, right? Who knows? There's a lot of possibilities that this little thing in information war pops up with this stupid map stuff again. You can definitely see Kherson being the region to hold, but, you know, wanting to connect to Transnistria, this triggering Moldova's response. Let's see. Let's confirm all that. Right? Give it a 24-48 hour rule. Seems like a very ambitious military operation to liberate Odessa, Mykolaiv. You could see it. You could see it. But as we said yesterday, I mean, if the cost of going in, and once you have these many things managed and the political side massaged, everything into place, yay, and how it should be over here and everything, and it's on the Russian side, fairly popular endeavor. So they're managing their losses and reproducing their victories. They have what we got confirmation on about the use of satellite on the Ukrainian side and how their strikes may be more precise at a shorter distance, or for strikes that are harder to aim otherwise without this. So there, and that was being said. Reshetnikov said that that's being coordinated directly out of Poland and like plugged in on a screen real time, like positioning of the their artillery systems on the ground, surface to surface types of systems are being aimed, like controlled from like that. And he referred to the guys like actually manning those systems as zombies, because the like calibration of the weapons and like the desired strike range is being calibrated in real time from satellites to a computerized control network run out of Poland, is what Reshetnikov said. Right? He's the retired lieutenant general of the Russian Foreign Service, run for Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, SVR, right? So anyway, it's interesting. We'll see how this plays out. Only so much speculating that you can speculate, but it would, you know, just as we have said, it would make sense once you're in the cost of going in, et cetera, et cetera. They're only going to be more, it's only going to be more expensive later on. It's only going to be more expensive later on. You can freeze the conflict and stuff to a certain extent, or freeze aspects of the conflict and still try to strike if they're receiving weapons or something. I still try to strike those shipments. And you might, they might do this. They might have in Odessa, Mykolaiv, just as they're doing like in Kherson and Zaporizhia, if they do the same like that, then what they would do is first have like these neighborhood committees at these different municipal levels, like get resolutions through, passed through the city, you know, councils and stuff. And then, so the city council votes a certain way, or certain settlement votes a certain way. And then they have these regional meetings, and then they vote to that they're going to organize a yes, no large, a yes, no vote on a larger total public vote, like for a referendum. And then they do a vote on the referendum, and then like they say that they're a self, you know, self-declared mini republic, right? And that would have to happen when the you know, some process where you know, getting, I don't want to get into details right now or, you know, blow anything up, but I understand the process that they would use, and as they use it, we'll talk about it. But no, I'm not going to divulge the specific tactics, because it hasn't happened yet. Wouldn't be right. So that's my assessment for today. Just that was it. We just didn't mention that part of it. Like what? But other than that, I think that we've covered the whole terrain. What's going on? Thank all of you for joining us today. And yeah, we'll wrap it up with that. Take care and have a great rest of the day.